Hello, I'm Suzanne Paris. This is number 0624, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0624. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Anne Burke, who is the author of the true crime novel, The Seventh Shot, which chronicles a murderer that she actually went to school with.
We went to school together, and then in the late 1990s, a school friend from the same class, grade 12 it was at that time, at a rural high school, said to me, "Did you hear about Ron West? Do you remember him from school?" I said, "Vaguely. He was this rather odd fellow, one of those people that goes fairly unnoticed a lot of the time, very quiet." And I said, "No, I didn't know." He said, "Well, he became a Toronto cop, and they just arrested him," and this was in 1999, he said, "for the murder of two nurses back in 1970.
British film director Mark Price, who makes micro-budget films, is back on the show after a decade since the release of his zombie film, Colin, which cost all of $75 to make. It's a film that Martin Scorsese saw.
Someone had sent me a tweet saying, "Oh, I see Martin Scorsese has seen your film." I scrolled through the article, and it's basically Martin Scorsese saying he doesn't really like zombie movies. He likes vampire movies. And I thought, oh no, Martin Scorsese is going to say zombie movies are bad, especially this one, Colin. But instead, when I got to that section of the interview, he said, "Yeah, there's not much going on in zombie movies." He said, "But there's this one film, Colin." And I was like, "What?" And then he started saying all this really lovely stuff about, you know, how energetic and aggressive the shooting style was and how it sort of drew him in.
Science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, talks about the dueling billionaires who recently went to space and how he felt about the missions.
It was very interesting to see how commercial, particularly Virgin Galactic, was. The feel was really very different, that it was a for-profit thing, and going up and getting your astronaut wings, it kind of brought an interesting feeling out in me. I don't want to say that it cheapens the whole idea of going into space, but definitely it's something that I never expected, even as a person who's deeply involved in space exploration, to go through these feelings of going, well, this is not, doesn't quite feel the same.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0624, was Suzanne Paris, who is a graphic artist and writer right here in Montreal. Thank you very much, Suzanne, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An unnamed man in Yakima, Washington, got arrested on July 24th after a curious incident inside his home. The man was stocking his refrigerator with soda cans when one exploded. He pulled a handgun out of his waistband and fired a round into the bottom of the fridge. When police arrived, the man was outside of his home in the alley, yelling incoherently, police said, with a gun lying on the ground. He told police that he believed the people living in the basement were trying to kill him. But it turns out that no one lives in the basement, because there is no basement in the home. He also told police that he found the gun, but he was arrested for second-degree unlawful possession of a firearm and discharge of a firearm. Huh. Yelling incoherently, huh?
I'm the hootin'est, tootin'est, shootin'est bobtail wildcat in the West. I'm the fastest gun north, south, east, and west of the Pecos.
Time for a checkup from the neck up. Meanwhile, let's just go ahead and pronounce that fridge dead. On ice, as it were. or perhaps now incapable of making ice. On July 15th, a 19-year-old driver from Hingham, Massachusetts, swerved to avoid hitting a squirrel in the road and ended up in the living room of a historical home built by Abraham Lincoln's great-grandfather in 1650. The unnamed driver drove off the right side of the road, over the sidewalk, and into the front of the house at around 6:30 a.m., where residents were still sleeping upstairs. Police said the driver was issued a citation for failing to stay in marked lanes. Wow, I'm not going to lie. At least one squirrel has met its demise under the tires of my vehicle, but at least I've never hit an historical home. Here's another numbskull behind the wheel. The Oakland County, Michigan Sheriff's Office reported that an unnamed 31-year-old woman in Pontiac, Michigan, had a panic attack on July 27th when she discovered a bed bug in her car. So she poured rubbing alcohol inside the car and set it on fire. In the process, she accidentally set herself on fire too, suffering second-degree burns. Good night. Sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite, set your car alight, and have fun explaining this to your insurance company. Okay, I hope you're sitting down for this next one. An unnamed man in Jinhua, China, was hospitalized after he inserted a 20-centimeter long eel into his anus on July 20th to ease his constipation. The folk remedy backfired on him, however, when the eel slithered up into his colon and bit through it, entering his abdomen. Shockingly, the eel was still alive when it was surgically removed. The surgeon said the man could have died from bacteria in the large intestine migrating into the abdominal cavity. Wow. I bet he's someone who's not getting a COVID vaccine. Someone who would have put a live eel up their butt probably doesn't have much use for modern medicine. I'm also guessing someone else had to coax him into going to the hospital. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have an Olympic story. You know all those stories we keep hearing about all the condoms handed out to Olympic athletes each time the games are held? Well, 27-year-old Australian Olympic kayaker Jess Fox showed her MacGyver chops in Tokyo on July 27th, using an Olympics-issued condom to repair her kayak before winning bronze and gold medals in different events. Fox used the condom to hold in place a carbon mixture that is applied to the tip of the kayak. Said Fox on an Instagram post, "Bet you never knew condoms could be used for kayak repairs." She went on to say, "It gives the carbon a smooth finish." Smooth indeed. I'm now waiting for the Olympic Committee to revoke her medals because of the use of a foreign substance. Sometimes they're just no fun. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ann Burke is the author of the true crime novel The Seventh Shot, which recounts two grisly Ontario murders that took place decades ago and the efforts of police detectives to unravel the senseless brutality of these crimes. Ann joins us on the line from Ontario. Hi, Ann.
Hello, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. First of all, let's start with the title. Why is the book called The Seventh Shot?
Well, The Seventh Shot actually sort of the nexus of the whole story. At the first murder site, that was of the young nurse Doreen Morby. The first officers on site, when they realized that Doreen had been shot seven times, the comment was made fairly early on, who shoots someone six times and then reloads to shoot them a seventh time. So very early on, back in 1970, they had already pretty much established in their mind that the individual that shot the first and second person, because they did connect the two pistols, but was likely a fairly rare nine-shot revolver. that they were looking for. So this is something that stayed with them for the almost 30 years that they were searching for the 22 caliber killer. And now, that's why I came up with the seventh shot.
Okay. Now, the person who is suspected of being this serial killer is actually somebody you knew?
Yes, we went to school together, and I didn't really, like the two murders that the book mainly focuses on, I wasn't really aware of anything to do with them. And then in the late 1990s, a school friend from the same class, grade 12 it was at that time, at a rural high school in Ontario, said to me, "Did you hear about Ron West? And do you remember him from school?" I said, "Vaguely." He was this rather odd fellow, one of those people that goes fairly unnoticed a lot of the time, very quiet. And I said, "No, I didn't know." He said, "Well, he became a Toronto cop, and they just arrested him." And this was in 1999, he said, for the murder of two nurses back in 1970. So I kind of put this in the back of my mind. And then when it came about the time that I was thinking I'd like to write a book, it was sort of on my bucket list in retirement, I thought this would be interesting. And I thought, too, that I might be able to have an easier route of contacting some of the people involved in that, having grown up most of my life in the same area, and, you know, for acquaintances and so on. And also because I'd had some contact earlier with the police, it made it a little easier to make those contacts.
Now, in addition to the murders that he was sent to jail for, there is speculation that there are more victims out there at his hand, correct?
Yes. Likely one that was established was back in 1995, and that was in Blind River, Ontario, the north shore of Lake Huron, Georgian Bay. And he was living in the area at the time, and there were some, it was a roadside killing of a couple of people and a wounding of another person. And he was suspected for that, but they were never, ever able to confirm, not have enough really evidence to at least take it to court. And it's still, unfortunately, a cold case. Even the first two cases were at one time the two oldest cold cases in all of Canada at one time. So it was a long case, but there still isn't enough to close the 95 case. And he's pretty much served his time now. He's never applied for parole. So we may never know about, I'm not sure he'll ever own up to anything else, but I've had other people come to me since the book came out and insist that they are also victims, living victims, but of him. So
you mentioned that he's almost served his time, so there's the potential that he could get out?
Yes, there is. Yes, he served his time. Like I said, he's never applied for parole, because I'm sure he wouldn't want to face the families that are bound to show up every time he came up for parole. But he was in serving for some robberies at the time he was charged. So he had some time already in for, you know, had put in time. And then he started his time for the two homicides in 2002. So I would imagine by 2022 that he will be out into a halfway house, or at least he might be out on days at this time. I'm really not sure. I've tried to have contact with him, but he's never given anyone an interview, not a soul. So he's laid pretty low.
Those other murders that you say are cold cases that still have not been solved, are they getting any warmer due to modern technology and forensics, or are they just as cold as they always were?
Well, the one I'm talking about in Blind River, unfortunately, how it took place, it was two people that had pulled over in Winnebago, and any forensic evidence that would have been available there would have been in the Winnebago, because the people had decided to stay overnight there. He'd knocked on the door and said, you can't park here overnight. He would often pose as a policeman because he had been an ex-policeman, and I guess he realized people listened to him. And the homicide had taken place inside the Winnebago, which has long ago been destroyed. So there was nothing there. The other man that showed up on the scene that was shot through the windshield, there was really no contact there either made. So they're hoping one day maybe somebody will find the weapons that might have been thrown in a lake or anything that was taken from one of the suspects. But it's pretty, you know, like I say in the book, if anybody remembers something or they come up with something that seems odd, you know, be sure to go to the Blind River OPP and tell them about it. It's always going to be open.
In doing your research, you mentioned you went to school with this guy, but he was pretty much nondescript and you don't have great memories of him. But in doing your research, did it sort of ring any bells or give you an aha moment to something about him when you did know him from school?
Well, it's odd you'd ask that, because when I started reading a little bit more about behaviors, I found there were a lot of things that about him at that time that wouldn't have been immediately obvious. He definitely fit the model of somebody developing into a psychopathic personality. Yes. Mm. And odd as well. And I didn't know this at all when I wrote the book, but it's incredible. After I finished the book, it was right about the time they had arrested the Golden State Killer in California. And the parallels between those two men are unbelievable. And it's quite striking. Both police officers both started off actually doing small thefts and so on, both abused by their mothers, both fathers were either left or died when they were young. And it's just amazing. You go on and on, and people keep telling me more things that they've noticed. So, you know, I'm sure they'll learn something down the road about patterns, and maybe they can stop or intervene at some point with personalities that might be inclined to, you know, to go this way. I'd like to think so.
Not that I want to be an alarmist or anything, but I've had the opportunity to talk to many people who are true crime novelists. And in most cases, they're dealing with someone who is either dead or is behind bars and will never get out. But mm-hmm. Here you are writing a book about someone who could potentially get out, who is a police officer, so he has investigative skills, who also went to school with you, and you're writing books about a story where he could be potentially the murderer of other people that he was not convicted for. Does this concern you that he's getting out?
No, not really. No, I don't think he would ever do anything to draw attention to himself. I would imagine, I feel fairly strongly that he'd spend the rest of his life avoiding any kind of contact with anyone who might know him. I'd be very surprised at that. I really would. There's no one in his family that would ever, you know, welcome him home or anything like that. So he has two sons, surviving sons, who certainly will have nothing to do with him. So I don't particularly feel that way.
Do you think, or do you know, if any of his family members have read your book? And do you think of the possibility?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Do you think of the possibility of him reading your book?
Oh, yes. I do. If he had the opportunity to, he probably would, out of curiosity. He'd probably even want to correct me if I made any mistakes. I'm quite sure they're usually, just from what I've read, their personalities, they want you to get it right when they do these horrible things. So that would be the only time he might make contact, was to make sure I got something right or to correct me. But you asked about family. It was interesting because I just heard recently I was curious about family because there were none I could really connect with. And I did hear from a cousin that told an old friend of mine, she said, oh, she got his personality down absolutely right, because he did terrible things as a child. You know, all the warning signs were there. He tied up his brother, tried to burn him, and burning barns, all those sort of things that I've generally considered warning signs.
A fascinating story indeed. The book is called The Seventh Shot. Anne, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much.
Anne Burke, author of the true crime novel The Seventh Shot. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0624, and you'll find links to Anne's website, plus also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to British film director Mark Price. Also, Andrew Mazakis, the night sky guy, talks about billionaires in space. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more in Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can also find us on several fine radio stations, such as WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, CFMU in Hamilton, and CFMH FM in St. John, New Brunswick. Thanks to all for joining in. Don't touch that dial. Well, Sheila Copeland could probably have gotten her husband out of jail. He's accused of plotting a terrorist attack, but U.S. District Judge Alex C. was inclined to authorize his release from jail. C. had conditions, though, such as that the defendant could not communicate with militia groups, and Copeland would have to make sure her husband stuck to those conditions. If he didn't, and she didn't report it, she could end up in jail, too. Copeland had testified to her husband's good character and agreed to supervise him, but after Judge C. explained what would be involved, she consulted her lawyer and changed her mind. So after a long hearing, C. left Copeland's husband right where he was, behind bars in Santa Clarita, California. If he wants to get out, he'll have to find someone else to monitor him. Someone more supportive, or just more willing to turn him in. Remember those vows to have and to hold from this day forward, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, during insurrection or coup, to love and to cherish as long as we both shall live? Touching. Okay, last September, Refugio and Angelina Jimenez went to a park at the foot of the San Bernardino Mountains in California for a gender reveal party. They made their revelation with a pyrotechnic device, which promptly set fire to the dry grass, which spread into a 22,680-acre inferno that destroyed 5 homes and damaged 4 others and took more than 2 months to contain. The couple will likely be on the hook for the millions of dollars it costs to fight the fire, and last week a grand jury indicted them on dozens of criminal counts, including recklessly causing a fire to inhabited structures and recklessly causing a fire to property of other. Oh, and a few more felonies. Manslaughter. Since U.S. Forest Service hotshot firefighter Charles Morton, who was 39, was killed fighting the fire, and 13 other firefighters were injured, each leading to a charge of recklessly causing a fire with great bodily harm. The couple faces up to 30 years in prison. Well, since they like reveal parties, they must have really enjoyed the grand jury revealing their decision. By the way, the gender of the baby was never released to the media. But years from now, he, she, or they will have a compelling tale to share at show and tell in school. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a gardener was working on a customer's lawn in Boynton Beach, Florida, when he noticed a car rolling by. The driver was unconscious. The worker, identified only as Tony, ran after the car, which came to rest on someone else's lawn. Tony found the car doors were locked and yelled for help, but the only response was the homeowner, who screamed, "Get off our lawn and have him die somewhere else." Wow. A lot of love in that neighborhood. Tony recognized the man and knew where he lived, so he ran to that address and notified the man's wife, who called 911 and presumably arrived with a spare key to the car. 2 days later, the sheriff's office got a call. "I want to talk to Tony," the caller said. "He saved my life." Wow. Maybe you can buy Tony a cell phone, because apparently he needs one. Also, the two of you can get together next Halloween to egg your neighbor's house. Heck, why wait? Do it now. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? It was way back in 2010 when we last spoke to our next guest. Mark Price is a film director in the UK. When we last spoke to him, he was touting his extremely low-budget British horror film, Colin, which he completed for the whopping price of $75. Well, I'm guessing he's working with slightly larger budgets these days. He's recently completed a couple of films, Night Shooters and Dune Drifter. Mark joins us via Skype from London, England. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Thanks for having me back after all this time. Thanks for remembering me after all this time.
Nice to have you back on the program with us. So before we get to the two newer films that you've been doing, which I assume you're working on a slightly larger budget these days, how did Colin do, and what was the reaction, and how has it lived on in its older age?
It's done really nicely. I mean, it's one of those things I kind of, as soon as the film sort of, a film I make tends to get out, I tend to shy away from it a little bit then and just go, well, it's been set free now and I can't do anything more. I can't control anything. I'm just going to sort of let it go. And I think my fear at the time was I made a niche zombie movie for only a section of the zombie sort of fan base. I thought this film isn't going to land with every zombie fan, but it's going to be kind of cool for at least zombie fans like myself. And so then when it got all this mass press, I was terrified. I thought, well, hang on, whoa. Now people like my mum have heard of it. so like that, it might not necessarily be a film that is going to really, it's certainly not going to be a film that's going to appeal to people on a mass scale. And one of the things that was nicest about it was that I would get a lot of messages from people who say, I don't watch zombie films, but I really enjoyed this one. You know, I didn't get lynched in the way that I thought I would, in terms of people going, you wasted 97 minutes of my time and die on the internet, you jerk. You know, I didn't get any of that, fortunately. Well, not too much, at least.
Well, let's look at some of the high praise. I understand that Martin Scorsese saw your film.
Yeah, that was, I remember, I was actually, funny enough, coincidentally, I was looking after Alistair Curtin, the man who plays Colin. I was looking after his cat. Him and his partner went on holiday. So I was in his flat and someone had sent me a tweet saying, oh, I see Martin Scorsese has seen your film. I remember thinking, oh, okay. This is 3 a.m. before they went. They cooked me food and they were leaving in the morning. And I scrolled through the article and it's basically Martin Scorsese saying he doesn't really like zombie movies. He likes vampire movies. And I thought, oh no, Martin Scorsese is going to say zombie movies are bad, especially this one, Colin. But instead, when I got to that section of the interview, he said, there's not much going on in zombie movies. He said, but there's this one film, Colin. And I was like, what? And then he started saying all this really lovely stuff about, how energetic and aggressive the shooting style was and how it sort of drew him in. And I think he caught it on the Horror Channel whilst he was in the UK shooting Hugo. Like that's the best we've been able to figure out. But I think I was so excited I couldn't really sleep then. I was sort of like dancing around waiting for Alistair to wake up. Because I thought, shall I burst into his room and say, Martin Scorsese saw a movie? But that would be weird because, you know, him and his partner's asleep. And if there's one thing I've learned in life is you don't burst into people's rooms whilst they're asleep screaming excitedly about stuff that, you know, involves you. So,
well,
you
know. I'm assuming in the, 12 years now since the film came out, that it's finally in the black.
Oh, yeah, I think it was. We did okay. Yeah, it's interesting because with all these films, every first-time filmmaker, they have this sort of distribution sort of like minefield they have to navigate through. And I don't think we did too bad. I mean, we had... like Kaleidoscope really wanted to push the film here in the UK and they handled it and they've still got it. I think they've still got it for another couple of years. But I think it's been, you know, it was one of their like successes, which is quite nice. So it's been okay. And the weird thing is I went from that into, I made another small film, this one that no one saw called Magpie, which is like a little small sort of personal drama. I think that's got US distribution actually. And then I sort of went on to do development in film for a while, development in television for a while, which meant you got paid to write stuff that no one would ever make. And I think after a few years, I started to panic and thought, wow, I haven't made anything in ages. I really need to make a film or something. And that's when Night Shooters cropped up and we sort of did that one pretty quickly for a small budget.
I saw a little bit of the behind the scenes. I believe it was for Dune Drifter, if I'm not mistaken. And I think one of the things you mentioned in that, which made my heart sing, was talking about following in the footsteps almost of Roger Corman.
Yeah, I think Corman was always a massive influence for me. I think because when I was a kid, one of the things I'm aware of as an adult is that I couldn't tell the difference between, you know, the quality of Star Wars in terms of effects and adventure and story and the quality of something like Space Raiders or Battle Beyond the Stars. So when I was sort of making, when it came to doing Dune Drifter, I knew that realistically, looking at what, you know, is being done with sort of space battles and that sort of stuff in you know, Star Trek Discovery or Picard or any of the new Star Wars films, I was like, well, we can't really do that with miniatures or the sort of rendering power of the laptops that we were sort of oddly backed into using. Because the pandemic hit and all of our visual effects shots were being put together for the Starfighter sort of battle. That was done in our homes. And my miniatures guru was up in Scotland. He'd shot some of the miniature stuff in London. Then he went up to Scotland to visit family. That's when lockdown happened. Scotland was a little bit more strict than England. And so he sort of stuck up there for the most of it. And he said, well, look, I've got everything I need to do some of them as miniatures, some of them as CG. So let's see what works. And so we managed to sort of finish the film in lockdown. I had a Starfighter right here in my living room that was only meant to be here for a few weeks. And because we needed to shoot some extra shots with the actors, we needed a rear projection screen for that. It just had to live here for about 6 months. So I had a Starfighter in my living room for 6 months. Even then we couldn't film what we needed to because, you know, it just wasn't, the pandemic still hasn't really gone away at this stage. So, what we did was I had to come up with new ways to film stuff using my then partner who would double for the pilots, or my flatmates who would double for the pilots. And it was quite a fun experience making Dune Drifter or finishing it in lockdown.
Well, I get the feeling both from talking to you the last time when we were talking about Colin and now as we talk about Dune Drifter, that one of the things you truly do enjoy is not only the process, but the economy of the process, because it kind of forces you to be more creative.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that was really interesting with Dune Drifter that I always was very, very aware of is that we had had the characters in these helmets. And what you do when you stuff a character in a helmet is you really reduce a lot of what, like, the human eye needs to recognize people. It's the reason why in World War II movies they take off their helmets all the time. So there's a little calm briefing scene, so someone will take off their helmet and they'll have a chat. They only do that to help you recognize the actors playing them, to help, you know, because your brain doesn't, like, you need that information. We need the shape of a head and how ears look on people. It's really strange. You wouldn't think you need that until you're watching a film like Doomdrift and you don't know any of the, like, 14 characters playing gunners and pilots. So what we'd have to do is come up with a unique camera angle to help visually signify that this is this character speaking and this is this character speaking. And once we establish all of that in the opening section, once we get into the action sequence and the space battle and the cutting is a lot faster, we know who we're looking at based on the camera angle, because that sort of visual language has been sort of ingrained in your head, along with the fact that we also cast people with distinctly different faces. And so there was a lot that we did to make that work. I mean, that was like, that's not the thing I talk about the most of it. It's normally miniatures and how we would do explosions in our living room using a cold spark material that we'd heat on the oven, on the stove, run around the corner and just throw it at the actors whilst they were screaming. And it would look like an explosion. All totally safe, but you know, it would look spectacular. And like, that's what I normally talk about. But the thing with the helmets is the thing that I think I'm the most pleased with, because I think we really do find a lot of character in all of our pilots and gunners in that opening sort of sequence before we kill most of them off in a big fiery battle sequence.
Well, we've got just about a minute, so you got to tell me the elevator pitch about what Dune Drifter is all about.
Dune Drifter is about a group of rookie pilots who are last minute drafted into a space battle, and it goes horribly wrong, and two of them crash on a nearby planet and have to basically fight to survive to repair their ship and get back home. I wonder if they make it.
So what are you working on next?
The next thing we got is, I think thanks to Night Shooters and our work on Doom Drifter, our financiers have sort of combined with someone else, who's another amazing sort of producer and financier, to do another sort of martial arts action movie. It's a game, really. So it's for Steam, the gaming platform. So it's almost like a choose your own adventure type story. But one of the things we realized is that we can actually make a movie out of it as well. So we're making a game where the audience gets to decide what route to take to finish the story, sort of like Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror episode. But we realized that there's enough in there for us to also make a film. So we're making both hopefully a satisfying game, but a really satisfying film. So that's our little one for that one, which I'm quite excited about.
Well, Mark, it sounds like you're living the life and doing it on the cheap as well. So that's fantastic.
Oh, it's just about covering rent and all the booze I want to buy. So yes, it's fine.
Mark, how can we get the films? How can we see the films, especially the last couple we've been talking about, Night Shooters and Dune Drifter?
There's a bit of a thing with Doom Drifter. Unfortunately, it was released, like a heavily censored version of the film was put out everywhere instead of my cut of the film, which is the one that was in festivals. So I do believe that the only way to see my cut of the film is if you buy the DVD. Don't watch the main feature, but watch the special features version of the film, which for some reason, I can't explain it. I don't really know what happened. We weren't happy about it, is all I can say. And so that's my version of the film. Or failing that, just ping me a message on Instagram or Twitter and I will just send you the link, which I've done to many people so far.
Excellent.
But Night Shooters, I think that's getting released in the US in the next few months.
Excellent.
I think it's a North American release as well, so I think it should also be out in Canada. So I'm not 100% sure. They don't involve me in these decisions anymore, which is kind of nice because I just, you know, but at the same time, it also means I'm very uninformed on the journeys of my own films.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for bringing us up to date and continued success in all you do.
Thank you very much, Peter. I really appreciate it.
Director Mark Price. His two most recent films are Night Shooters and Dune Drifter. And his big micro-budget film from a decade ago, Colin, is still going strong. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0624, and you'll find links to the trailer for Night Shooters and also a behind-the-scenes look at the movie Dune Drifter. You can also find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can buy the DVD of his first film, Colin. And you can also find links to Mark's previous appearance on the show, which is show number 0064, from way back in November of 2010. It's up on the Audia audio service under the title Mark Price, Horror on a Tiny Budget. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. So, Andrew, we didn't get to talk about this last month because they happened after we went to air, but let's debate the battling billionaires who went up into space. Virgin Galactic's Richard Branson versus Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's so interesting to me because I've been really waiting for these flights for years, you know, as a space journalist covering these two stories from their origins over a decade ago when, you know, the plans were laid out to develop space tourism. It was really interesting to see Virgin Galactic really being very gung-ho and having their own mindset of what they're going to be doing. And that's really like a major thrill ride is what they were billing, what they were looking for. And, you know, at a cost of $250,000 per seat that they're looking for customers. They've sold over 600 tickets. And then watching them kind of stumbling along the way over the years, finally now, of course, reaching the climax of doing a flight with astronauts and, of course, having the chief of the company, Richard Branson, there. It was really interesting to see. And it is a milestone. I mean, there's no doubt about it to me. And so as was Jeff Bezos. But I found the two, for me, were the feelings that it left me, because I'm always been a fanboy of, the astronaut program, NASA, growing up with the next generation after Apollo is my generation, the space shuttle astronauts building the space station. And I guess I've always put astronauts on a pedestal in fact, as heroes and stuff. And then seeing this commercialization and actually seeing it come out in play, watching it online, streaming it. I was looking at CNN, looking at the company streams, both from Blue Origins and Virgin Galactic. And I just found it was very interesting to see how commercial, particularly Virgin Galactic, was. The feel was really very different, that it was a for-profit thing, and going up and getting your astronaut wings, is it, you know, it kind of brought an interesting feeling out in me, in that going, I don't want to say that it cheapens the whole idea of going into space, but definitely it's something that I never expected, even as a person who's deeply involved in space, actually, to go through these feelings of going, well, this is not, doesn't quite feel the same. And it's just to me, what Virgin Galactic is offering is a thrill ride, really, a super expensive thrill ride for the uber rich. Whereas maybe perhaps what we are seeing from Jeff Bezos, from what I'm hearing, where the company's going, is that they want to do more. Their goal, ultimate goal, isn't just space tourism, but maybe moving forward and placing maybe industries in space, of doing benefit for humanity, for the rest of us, and maybe transforming travel, you know, air travel or space travel in a real sense.
Well, let me jump in there, because you were talking about how this cheapens a little bit the idea of being an astronaut, right?
Yes.
I think, first of all, that both of these things are fantastic, and they're the wave of the future, going beyond where we are right now, and this could lead to other great things. However, what you said about the wings, I fully agree. And by that, I mean, if you take a cruise on a ship, you're not a sailor. If you take a flight from here to London, England, you're not a pilot. You're a passenger. There's nothing special about that. I'm sorry, but there isn't. So these people getting their quote-unquote astronaut wings, they are not astronauts. I mean, in the case of Bezos's flight on, you know, let's be honest, the penis rocket, there's not even somebody flying that thing.
Yeah, no pilots, autopilots.
There's no pilot. So I'm sorry, they're not astronauts. They're passengers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I'm not cheapening the experience that they've had, but the idea of giving them astronaut wings, I think, does a disservice to actual astronauts who train for it.
Yeah, and it's let's not forget, there's also the debate of actually where do you enter space, right? I mean, we see that in the media being played out, of course, the rivalry between the two companies as well. Where is that line? The Kármán line, which is at 100 kilometers in altitude, is the officially internationally recognized demarker of where space begins. The boundary between Earth's atmosphere and space is 100 kilometers. Whereas NASA and FAA here in the United States mark off a much a lower altitude level. And Virgin Galactic just barely made the U.S. recognized boundary, not the international boundary. The Blue Origins did make the international boundary. So there's this whole other demarcation of where do you actually enter space. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, to me, these are just thrill rides as they are now. But it does perhaps set off this trajectory in terms of technology, of building technology, rocket technology, and space travel on a new course, where we're going to have the uber rich basically paying for the development of the next generation rockets that really democratizes space. You know, we hear that idea of democratizing space exploration, space travel. That is the ultimate goal. And maybe if we look at the paradigm of how air travel came to be more democratized over time, you know, originally getting a seat on a jet aircraft in the 1960s was super expensive. And now here we are, you could fly for a couple of $1,000s literally to any place in the world. And anyone can just buy a ticket online within minutes, you know, on your credit card. So it is, the air travel has been truly democratized. Can we expect the same from the rocket industry, from space travel?
Well, maybe, it's interesting because
this is the beginning. You know, the uber rich began the air travel, maybe the same with rockets.
But you say democratize, and I use another word, which I think has a bit of a negative connotation, and that is commercialize. because there is a crass commercialization of what we know as flight today, and we can see that in space as well. And I mean, you got to take the good with the bad, but the bad I'm not so crazy about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no doubt about it, this the cheapening that you're mentioning. And that's that, you know, we have to remember, though, it's not the same. Air travel and space travel are two different things. And the risk level with space travel is never going to go away like it had, at least not for many generations, I think, like what we see with air travel. You know, I kind of wonder what happens when, you know, there is a disaster, and it will happen. I mean, we don't know when that's going to happen. Now that you have multiple companies, and there'll be more and more of these companies coming in the pipeline, offering these rides to people into space. And traveling into space is just inherently risky at a much different level than air travel. So the question is, will they ever make it to that point? I doubt it. And what happens when there are these disasters? Is the industry going to fall apart, the space tourism industry? You know, what happens when you will have, you know, God forbid, you know, some of your tourists stuck on the moon? You know, well, something where they crash land and they're stuck there and you can't bring them back. What happened?
It's interesting when you talk about disasters, because one thing we were looking to talk about on previous shows when we first started talking about these two guys going into space was another company that was giving the opportunity for people to travel into the atmosphere or through the atmosphere in balloons. A company called Space Perspective, which was going to allow you to spend $125,000, which is certainly a lot cheaper than the other two guys' missions, to allow space tourism. But when you talk about something like potential disasters, I look at that space balloon and all I see is Hindenburg 2. It really is kind of scary.
Well, yeah, it's not for everyone. You know, you have the stadium-sized balloon taking you up there. You know, if something goes wrong, there's no gliding down, you know, there's no bouncing onto the ground or anything like that. So, you know, yeah, I mean, it's just going into space, particularly crossing that boundary. It's an extreme environment and temperatures and, you know, the vacuum of space, it's radiation. I mean, the list goes on. And it just becomes more tricky to maintain that habitable environment of you living, you know, being able to live and breathe in a tin can, basically. You know, looking forward, I mean, yes, there's going to be people, risk takers. There's ones, you know, the ones that like to jump out of a plane or do bungee jumping or whatever, the extreme adventurers, they're going to be. But can they make the rocket industry such that it's safe enough for everyday man to take advantage of? That's what they're saying. You listen to what Bezos says, you know, and what Elon Musk at SpaceX is saying, is that they're looking to build a rocket technology that's not only reusable hundreds of times, but also allows you to basically hasten the development of a rocket plane that could get you to one side of the Earth within a couple of hours, like going from San Francisco to Tokyo in less than 2 hours.
I know you have a lot to say about this, because we've talked about this off air, but we've just about run out of time to talk about
it's a big topic.
I do have a minute left. And by the way, we can continue this conversation, because I know you have thoughts about the way the Bezos flight versus Branson flight was televised and prepared for an audience. I know you have thoughts on that, and I have thoughts on that, and our thoughts are a bit different from conversations we've had off air about this. So we'll continue this discussion on Patreon for the subscribers. And in the meantime, in less than a minute, can you mention an event that's taking place in August, and that is the Perseid meteor shower?
That's right. This is nature's best fireworks. Everywhere around the world can see this. So all you need is clear skies. You've got three really good windows of opportunities on August 11th, 12th, and 13th that people can go outside and count their wishes. Basically, these little motes of dusts from ancient comets are going to be raining down on Earth on August 11th, 12th, and 13th, and you see them as shooting stars or meteors. And they could be up anywhere from 60 to 120 shooting stars per hour on those nights. No telescope or binoculars required. Try to find a spot that has no light pollution or no direct lights, where it's dark enough, and just get comfortable, lay back down so you don't get a crink neck, and start counting those meteors, and they'll be right across the entire sky. Some will be very bright, some will be faint. There'll even be a few fireballs in there as well. So plenty of wishes to be made with the Perseid meteor shower. It comes around annually like clockwork, and this year is particularly good because the moon is going to be out of the way for the best peak times each of those nights. So as soon as it gets dark, folks can go outside and look at that, and that's for everyone around the world.
Excellent. So we'll take this conversation now to patreon.com to continue debating billionaires in space. Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy and the author of the National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0624, and you'll find links to Andrew's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. And Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more with Andrew as a Patreon reward extra, where we'll discuss more about billionaire boys and their expensive toys. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the selected patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Before we crown this week's idiot, I have to emphatically state how I feel about the two teenage girls in this story. They are the least empathetic, most vile, callous, and cold-hearted individuals I have come across in a long time, and you'll see why. Two girls, aged 16 and 17, were walking to a gas station in Medina Valley, Texas, on July 26th, when they noticed something in a drainage ditch. It turned out to be a dead man whom investigators believe hanged himself from a railing using what appeared to be a shirt. When the girls came upon the body, they called a friend who called 911. But before officers arrived on the scene, the girls allegedly helped themselves to the dead man's gold necklace, documenting the theft on Snapchat. The video was anonymously sent to the Bexar County Sheriff's Office, and deputies charged both with theft from a human corpse, which is a felony. A friend of the 17-year-old told officers she stole it because it matched her fashion style. Okay, these girls sicken me. But besides that, why would you malicious, ungrateful, heartless excuses for humanity document your thievery of a dead body and post it on social media for all the world to see? One reason, and one reason only. You're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0624. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0624. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were to play this episode backwards, any given this... Go ahead, try and figure that out.